Welcome to another exciting and stimulating episode of Flat Chat with me, Stuart Codling, and special guests, Ben Anderson, joining me in the studio, the editor of F1 Racing.
Yeah, happy to be here, Codders. Looking forward to more Flat Chat.
Indeed. Joining us down the line from deepest, darkest France, our star columnist, Mark Gallagher.
Nice to be speaking with you again.
Those wondering what on earth that strange warbling is in the background, a busker has set up outside the office. So we have a fourth person in the podcast today, a busker who has set up a contactless payment terminal soliciting minimum donation of £2, which is a new one on me. Then again, we are in Richmond, so one of the richest boroughs in London, so no surprises. So if you're feeling distracted by slight noises without, that is that. There's also the possibility that our connection might come crashing down yet again owing to the water ingress in the server room that happened on Friday when our air conditioning went on the fritz. So a little snippet behind the scenes of one of the world's largest media companies. But one thing that has happened properly this week is that the new issue of F1 Racing is out, featuring contributions from everyone around this virtual table. On the cover, we unwrap Sebastian Vettel's mindset and try and work out what's going on inside his head. The feature was written by the BBC's Andrew Benson, based on an exclusive interview he did with Sebastian round about Silverstone time. And it's highly rigorous. I suppose, without doing spoilers, part of the issue is at the moment that Sebastian's overdriving to compensate for the weaknesses of the car. And also he's kind of got to that kind of maturity, the mature stage in his relationship with Ferrari that we liken a little bit to the 7-year itch in a marriage, where Ferrari now have a younger driver to get excited about in the form of Charles Leclerc. So, chaps, what do you make of where Sebastian Vettel is? Mark, we'd better speak to you before our Wi-Fi connection drops us off again.
Great feature. We do love Andrew Benson's deep insight into matters of this kind. And F1 Racing aside, of course, and your organisation aside, I think Andrew's long coverage of Formula One and following the progression of careers like Sebastian Vettel gives him sort of an ideal position to observe what's happened. I mean, it is very interesting to look at what has occurred since Vettel left, you know, the safety and security of Red Bull Racing to go to Ferrari. Maybe Daniel Ricciardo could have looked at that and seen that when you step away from the place where you are winning and where you are successful, you really have to wonder the extent to which a driver fully understands how lucky they currently are to be in the place that they're at. And I think it was interesting to see Sebastian go to Ferrari and effectively now kind of end up in a similar position that Alonso found himself, where, you know, the championship doesn't happen. And there are a million and one reasons, and without going into the spoilers, any spoilers for this feature, but some issues are similar to Alonso's experience at Ferrari, some are different, but nevertheless, the fact remains that both these drivers joined the Italian team only to discover that their ambitions would be thwarted, and the frustration then creeps in, doesn't it?
Yeah, 5 seasons in. I think, Ben, that was kind of the lead of your commission to Benny in terms of the feature. 5 seasons in, what are the parallels? Where does he go from here?
Yeah, we talked about this in our season preview issue all the way back in March, that Vettel effectively faced a crossroads in his career this season between following the Alonso path of frustrated ambition and probably or possibly leaving Ferrari winless in terms of championships, or could he finally achieve something akin to the Schumacher dream, you know, which is a big part of his rationale for going there. Vettel hero worshipped Schumacher, became friends with him, looked up to him as a young driver growing up, went to Ferrari to try and emulate Schumacher's achievements, and it just hasn't happened. And it's not all Vettel's fault. You know, Ferrari aren't as well-oiled a machine as they were in Schumacher's heyday, but there have been chances there. He could have potentially won 2 titles in the last 3 seasons and just hasn't been able to get the job done, and mistakes have crept in. He's made mistakes. He's not looked like the driver that so effortlessly dominated Formula One with Red Bull, and the environment has to play a big role in that, and it's hard to see how they fully reconcile. Vettel's obviously contracted for one more year guaranteed at Ferrari, but as you mentioned, Cotter's, Charles Leclerc is coming up fast, and there are parallels which Andrew makes in the story with Vettel's own situation at Red Bull in 2014. Daniel Ricciardo in there as a new young driver, hungry to make his mark, and 12 months later Vettel was on his bike. And could the same thing happen at Ferrari with Leclerc?
One of the points Andrew addresses, and it's one that's almost become a cliche about Vettel's career, hasn't it, Mark? That he was sort of effortless in with a Red Bull chassis that he could manipulate and which worked, and which he could qualify on pole, and he could work the blown exhaust, the exhaust blown diffuser tricks. He was kind of peerless. He was almost unflappable, and his dominance was seamless. And yet, when he's kind of got to do the street fighting bit, he looks a little bit more fragile and prone to making mistakes in the heat of combat, as Marcus Pye would call it.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like Vettel's career at the pinnacle has experienced the reverse of what some other drivers have had, where you join the team that doesn't quite have the package, doesn't quite have the operational delivery, doesn't quite have the leadership, and then you progress to the team that brings you four world championships. He's managed to do it the other way around. He's won four world championships and gone to a team that, from a leadership point of view, has been through a number of changes of leadership. Technically, swings one way and another, and there's different concepts tried, and of course, you get to a year like this where they appear to have cracked the powertrain problem. You know, they've got very good straight line speed. But he doesn't have the car under him that he needs to do the job. And I know that's a point that Andrew mentions. And so Sebastian, to some extent, hasn't had the apprenticeship with the difficult circumstances. His introduction to Formula One via Red Bull, Toro Rosso, and then into Red Bull Racing, it was great. I mean, he had a wonderful package. I mean, he even won a Grand Prix in a Toro Rosso. And so he had a fantastic early stage. He's now had all these granular problems that have come with being part of the Ferrari setup. And the frustration has come out, and the anger has come out, and the mistakes have kind of flourished because it's not happening. And he can see it's not happening. And I think for a driver who has a great sense of the history of the sport, he perhaps more than anyone is now aware of the passing of time and the fact that 5 years in, it's just not happened. And where does he go next? So you've got a feel for the guy, because I think he was kind of unprepared for what he found at Ferrari. And I think that sort of that whole lack of stability that's been within the organization, and Sebastian having to somehow he's trying to find a way to personally compensate for the organization's difficulties. It's too much. And
he's quite a funny guy, isn't he, Ben, in a way, in that when you actually have those rare opportunities to speak to him, he's very engaging, he's funny, he's knowledgeable, and yet he hides away from people. He doesn't do social media. He keeps his media engagements to a minimum. He doesn't really like talking. It's as if he kind of views it almost like an office job, where he clocks in, does the driving job. He doesn't want to do any of the peripheral things that other racing drivers have to do because they answer to marketing departments and that sort of thing. He's sort of so good at it. He's a very private person. I find that quite bizarre.
Well, you can see why he got on so well with Kimi Raikkonen, can't you? Because Raikkonen is exactly the same. You know, wants to do his thing, live his life, and would be just as happy if there were no fans there, no media, no television cameras, and he could just get on with driving the car. But that's not the way that world works. Razzmatazz doesn't sit that well with Vettel, but independent of that, I think it's just a shame that for such a nice guy, such an intelligent guy, and very engaging out of the car, as you mentioned, it's that the problems that Mark has outlined so well seem to affect the driving. That's the thing you don't expect from a guy who's won four world championships, and maybe those circumstances of almost having it too good too early have created this gap in Vettel's experience and his knowledge, and therefore his ability to deal with the mud when it's thrown at him. Comparing him again to Alonso, Ferrari were similarly shambolic at times during his tenure there. But the one thing that never seemed to suffer for any more than the odd race with Alonso was the performance in the car. As much as he was getting on the team's case or having fallings out with various management types, he was relentless in the car, so close to winning the championship as well. Even in 2014, the final season when the car was awful, he was, some of his performances in that 2014 season were incredible. But you couldn't say that about Vettel this year. I mean, Vettel rated his own season just before the summer break.
Five
out of 10 so far. That's so far below what you expect for a guy in the lead seat and stated by the team boss, number one seat at Ferrari, and for a driver who's won that many races and that many championships.
There's also another interesting sort of mini parallel in what's happened to Kimi. So he's left Ferrari and risen brilliantly. He's carried the Alfa Romeo racing team. You know, he's done a fantastic job there for them. You've got Giovinazzi saying during the summer break that, what a great job Kimi's doing leading the team. Then you also think, well, actually, Kimi won Ferrari's last Grand Prix. You know, he won the United States Grand Prix in 2018. So actually, you have to go all the way back to a year ago to Sebastian Vettel winning in Belgium. You know, so there's, I think for every driver, whether it's Kimi, whether it's Sebastian, all drivers who go into Ferrari, to some extent or other, either at the beginning or later on in their sojourn there, they experience the difficulty that comes with being one of Maranello's finest. And then, of course, for Sebastian, as I'm sure you're about to go on to, Stuart, is then the Charles Leclerc factor.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, how some drivers who are young do flourish in a challenging environment and others don't. So you've had Leclerc who has, he's had some difficult cars to drive, and you might think that Ferrari isn't the right environment for a driver at his stage in his career, and yet he seems to be doing pretty well. He's making the odd mistake, whereas you see other drivers who come in, maybe not even to a potentially race-winning car, who come very highly rated, who just kind of fragment under the pressure. I mean, I remember giving John Booth a lift into Monza one year, and him saying to me, "Pisonia handled properly, I could have been world champion three times by now and I'd be living on beach." And I was so gobsmacked that the car was silent for a few seconds because I couldn't associate Antonio Pizzonia with winning anything except the sprint to the P45. Yeah. And yet there he was, highly rated by people who ran him in junior formula. But maybe there are some people who don't quite make it at the top level when they get there. I wonder if, looking at another Ferrari junior, whether we're kind of seeing that with Mick Schumacher this year, where, okay, so he's won a race in Formula 2. It was a reverse grid race, so not the most astounding victory. So you have to ask, is he all that? And is Sebastian's place in Ferrari maybe a little bit more comfortable than it might otherwise been if Mick Schumacher was ripping up the F2 right now?
Maybe. I think Leclerc is still the main threat internally, if you like. And the fact that Ferrari took the decision to leave a Kimi out Monza last season and then promote Leclerc so early suggests that they're finally seeing, well, A, the need to back youth and make something of the driver program that they have invested in. Following the kind of Red Bull model, you can see how well Red Bull have done in promoting Max Verstappen. Ferrari thinking, well, we've got a guy that's, he was rated at that kind of level coming up as well. Also, as a result of that, it suggests by its nature that they've lost maybe a bit of faith in Vettel. You know, he's been there for, as we said, five seasons now. If he was the guy, you wouldn't need to worry so much about having a Leclerc. Vettel is not quite at the same age range as Lewis. Mercedes, their debate about what to do with their second seat alongside Hamilton has to be partly informed by the fact that, Lewis is 34, going on 35. You can't be sure how long he's going to stick around in Formula 1, but Vettel's a bit younger, so in theory in the prime of his career, but he just isn't performing at the level where Ferrari can have full trust that when they get the car right, he's going to deliver the championships. And that's probably at the same time helping Leclerc bed in, because the Ferrari environment isn't quite there. Mattia Binotto says the team is more like the team he remembers from 97 when they were building up to winning a championship with Michael Schumacher, and that's a good place for Leclerc to make his mistakes and he's good enough that he can go into that environment and not be destroyed by the pressure or the difficulties. Whereas if you look at Pierre Gasly in at Red Bull alongside Max Verstappen, another guy highly rated, promoted into a top team probably a bit too soon, has floundered.
Yeah, sometimes the timing doesn't work out when you're running a junior program, does it, Mark? You either have people who haven't peaked, or maybe they do. Maybe you have a young driver who is coming to a position where you kind of need to put them in a top team, and you don't have a vacancy for them. So it's quite tricky for them, because we do have a feature with Esteban Ocon in this month, who is kind of a case in point in that he's had a year in limbo almost, because the Mercedes junior team had too many drivers coming up through the ranks, but not enough space to put them into.
Well, and Lance Stroll bought a team.
Yeah, that as well.
Do they take contactless payments? Maybe that's an idea for some junior teams. You could just have a contactless payment card on the way into the garage. you could wave. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I started a team in 2005, which is Stadis Grand Prix, and we ended up doing GP3, and we actually bought the Caterham GP2 team. And one of the things that I didn't notice because I knew about it, so one of the things we really tried hard to do with young drivers was to get the arm around them, really give them support and understand that, you know, especially these kids these days, I mean, they are kids, you know, teenagers, you know, they are leaving home for the first time, traveling around the world, they have a lot of pressure on them. They need a lot of support. You get the amazing driver who's immediately a winner in his first season in the category. You then get other drivers who need a learning year, which may be the case with Michael Schumacher, you know, Mick Schumacher, where you have a kind of learning year and then start to deliver. But you need that momentum. And then it's really important once a junior Formula driver is coming through into Formula One, it's really important that that momentum then continues again in Formula One. And, I mean, listening to the points, Ben, you were making, I mean, I was really reflecting on the fact that, you know, this kind of five-year itch at Ferrari, I mean, John Alesi was the kind of Charles Leclerc in some ways of the early 90s, albeit he went to Tyrrell first and then he got picked up by Ferrari. And I mean, when he went to Ferrari, he was this sort of legend already, you know, this young French driver who dared to battle wheel to wheel with Ayrton Senna in the Tyrrell, got to Ferrari, had 5 years, won one race and then left. And it was just a complete anticlimax. And I mean, I remember talking to Jean during his time at Ferrari and then subsequently and him saying, you know, we didn't have stability. There were technical changes all the time. We went through a particularly bad phase. You know, he felt a little bit happy. I mean, weirdly, he won his only Grand Prix in his final year at Ferrari before heading off to Benetton. So there's a bit of a repeat cycle happens, I think, with Ferrari. And I think one of the things that not Binotto, but actually one of the things that the owners of Ferrari, the shareholders, the people on high who make the key decisions really need to reflect about is rather than looking to the drivers to deliver the success, they've got to provide the stability and the leadership of the team for a long period of time. If Binotto has a bit of a shocker this year, they need to just let him put that down to experience and learn from it. And when you look at a team like Red Bull Racing and you consider that Adrian Newey has been there as technical director since 2005, and Christian Horner the same amount of time, you know, these guys are now a decade and a half into their leadership of that team. Ferrari needs to learn a little bit from the benefits of giving people time, and including their own leadership of the team in order to develop and to learn from their mistakes. And my biggest fear now will be Binotto will end up with another 3 or 4 years opportunity, and then he'll be swapped out for whoever the next leader is going to be. And you're just on a repeat cycle.
Yeah, the Italian media really, really do go for you if you're not delivering victories. And I remember Ross Brawn saying that one of the probably the most effective management things he did when he first came into Ferrari was stopping them reading the newspapers in the morning, because they were all far too obsessed with what was being written about them. I've got quite an amusing story about John Alesi as well, who apparently one of the problems with him was that he would never actually challenge anything the team did because he was so keen to be popular with them. And in, I think, only his second season, it would be, what, 92, he was driving with Ivan Capelli, and Capelli was saying in pre-season testing, there's something weird with the engine. It feels like it's tightening up in some of the high G corners. I don't know if like the oil scavenging is working properly. Of course, the engine department said, no, you know nothing, you new bloke. You know absolutely nothing. John, what's the engine like? John goes, no, nothing wrong with the engine. First Grand Prix, Capelli's car craps out within a few laps because of oil starvation. The sump wasn't baffled properly. So in the high G corners, the oil was disappearing over to one side of the engine and it wasn't being scavenged up and deployed. So both cars out with engine seizure and requiring an expensive and lengthy redevelopment process. Did anyone go to Capelli and say, sorry, we misjudged you, well, we should have listened to you? No, he got himself binned off before the end of the season.
The destruction of Ivan Capelli was something to behold, because I got to know the guy in Formula 3, and then in Formula 3000 he won the championship, and I was a pit lane reporter when he nearly won the French Grand Prix in a Lakenhouse March. I remember him standing on the podium with Alan Prost and Paul Ricard, and me thinking, you know, this guy is just going to be such a legend in the sport. He was killed by Ferrari within a year. And when I see him now in the paddock, you know, because he does, I think he does TV commentary, etc., and he's also involved in the management of Monza, I feel sorry for him every time I see him because of what could have been. And Ferrari managed to take away that huge abundance of talent and enthusiasm that he had.
Yeah, he was a broken man by the time he came to Jordan, wasn't he? I think he only did a handful of Grand Prix.
Ian Phillips might not like me saying it was a sympathy decision, but Ian Phillips had been obviously a big supporter of Ivan's at Lakenhouse March, because Ian was team principal and he was commercial director at Jordan. So I think Ian had a big role in helping Ivan to come back into Formula One, or to stay in Formula One for a short time with Jordan. But he was a broken man, and it was, you know, his career had been taken away from him by the experience. But
yeah, it's not an easy environment to be in, is it?
No.
That's the clear conclusion.
No.
From all of this. And Vettel doesn't seem exactly a broken man yet, and certainly he has all of that success to fall back on, at least in terms of, you know, girding himself mentally. But he does look a shadow, I think, of the driver that went to that team full of hope and dreams. He was brilliant in that first season in 2015, winning the odd race in a car that was way, way, way short of the Mercedes in terms of outright pace. But instability has been key. I think Mark makes a great point. And in terms of comparing Vettel to his idol Schumacher, I mean, Schumacher grew with that team, but that team had stability in the key senior positions, didn't it, throughout his time there. And they reaped the rewards ultimately, whereas Vettel hasn't had that. And now the regime is new again. They have to find out whether they really want to work with each other for the long haul. And that's, we don't know how long it's going to be before Ferrari get to the point where they could challenge for championship again, especially with Red Bull Honda on the rise and Mercedes looking almost impenetrable at the front.
I mean, isn't it extraordinary that we're sitting here, you know, recording this podcast on sort of the eve of the second part, where they after summer break part of this year's championship, and Ferrari hasn't won a race and Red Bull Honda have won two. None of this is in the game plan for Ferrari. None of this is in Sebastian Vettel's game plan for this year. And of course, to us in the media, Vettel is the outward-facing sort of leader of the team, and therefore all the pressure is with him internally and externally to deliver and to perform. And it's you have to feel for the guy. And I think even when Lewis Hamilton has been saying, you know, Sebastian's a great competitor, and of course we've both achieved so much success in our careers, and I almost think, you know, even Lewis seems like he feels a little bit sorry for Sebastian. You know, he's not quite in the position to add to those four world championship titles. And so the days when, you know, Lewis and Sebastian were level pegging, you know, we've won four world championships each, Lewis is just rocketing on to bigger things, and Sebastian is stuck in the Maranello rut.
Yeah, we're almost starting to look onto the next generation now, aren't we, for the rivalries,
yeah.
which brings us neatly onto the point of what to do with Esteban Ocon, who, you know, we might find out within the next few races, maybe even in the next few days, what's going to happen to him next year. Is he going to replace Valtteri Bottas? Is he going to be placed somewhere else? Might he even be kind of released from the programme? It's unlikely, but they might feel that, they being Mercedes, they might feel that George Russell is the better long-term bet, leave him in the oven a little bit longer at Williams and have Valtteri Bottas for another year. But the Jimmy Roberts interviewed him for the story we've done in this issue. And one of the things I found most extraordinary is just the bizarre existence of the modern Formula One reserve and test driver. So on European Grand Prix weekends, Ocon will clock up to 1,000 kilometres in the simulator at Brackley just on the Friday, go to bed really late, then up again at 4 a.m. to be driven to an airport so he can be flown to Europe just in case, as was the case in Hockenheim. Lewis Hamilton was feeling a bit sort of peaky and it was touch and go whether he was going to drive or not. And so Esteban has to be there ready to drive. So I suppose the question is, they're clocking up much more virtual mileage than actual mileage. Does that make it harder for a driver to come back after a year out? Because it doesn't seem to have hurt Kvyat, but Antonio Giovinazzi said that lack of actual racing really hurt him at the beginning of this year.
I've had a number of conversations with Mika Hakkinen about this exact topic, and Mika strongly believes that one of the wrong directions Formula One has taken is this lack of circuit time given to young drivers that come in because testing has been massively reduced. And I mean, Mika makes the point that in the early days of his career, and it took him 7 years before he won his first Grand Prix, in the early days of his career, he had almost unlimited testing. He was able to pound around and learn how the car worked and learn how the team worked. And so the simulators can do so much for you in terms of learning systems and processes and how to deal with certain scenarios while you're in the cockpit, and obviously reminding yourself about the track topography, etc. But can't be anything like actually driving the real car and being on the track with other drivers at the same time. So, from that perspective, it's a fundamental change. And I think for some drivers, it does give them a huge handicap when we then scrutinise them in the heat of battle. And really, they haven't had much experience of the heat of battle.
Yeah, the Kvyat thing's quite weird because he was someone who was the classic first lap nutcase, wasn't he?
The torpedo.
And yet we haven't seen that so much this year. His racecraft has been pretty good.
Yeah, I think a year out can do you some good if things haven't been going your way. I mean, Kvyat's career's had several resurrections. Most recently turfed out of Toro Rosso. He needed a mental reset. And he seems to have had that. His kind of year away at Ferrari, working on the simulator side in the background, seems to have done him some good. Probably helped him mature, learn a bit more about, big team organisations and working with people rather than it being just about him and what he does in the car on those 3 days of a Formula One weekend. And he's probably come back a more rounded individual, not necessarily a better driver, but a better person, maybe, a better professional, should I say. So it can be helpful. And well, 1 year out is probably when you've, done enough mileage in Formula One already, not enough to really screw you over. He's got enough experience. Whereas if you look at a driver like Robert Kubica, who's been out for so many years with injury, he is struggling because he's just had too many years out and Formula One has moved on so much from when he was last in it. And on top of his game, he can't make up the difference on the simulator. And that's where I think Mark's point is really valid. They're great engineering tools and they do help the drivers to some extent, but there is no substitute for the real thing. And you can last a year, maybe two. And so I think Ocon will be fine as and when he comes back. But for someone like Kubica, who's been, as I say, so many years out, it's just too much to make up.
Yeah. Do you suppose, Mark, that there's an argument to say that maybe the experience they get working with top-line people like Lewis Hamilton, etc., it actually compensates for the lack of track time? Because if you watch someone who is at the top of their game like Lewis, the way they manage the team around them, it must surely clue you in to some extent that being a winning Grand Prix driver is more than just about getting in a car and being quick.
Yes, which kind of begs the question why someone like Valtteri Bottas has been singularly unable to learn enough from watching Lewis to give himself the next step that he needed to in his career. I mean, Valtteri must now be able to write the book on what it is that Lewis has got that Valtteri himself has not been able to deliver upon. And it is an interesting and very difficult point that a lot of, I'm going to call them number twos, but I don't believe that Valtteri Bottas is a number two driver as such, but he has got to that point. And I think must be aware of that sort of holistic approach that Lewis takes. You know, even the fact that Lewis seems to be made stronger by stepping away from Formula One and enjoying his other activities in between races, then he comes back and he plugs in and he absolutely delivers. And the team knows he's going to deliver. And my goodness, you would love to be in a fly on the wall for some of the meetings and debriefs that they have, because the team will have the conviction that if anyone's going to deliver for him, it will be Lewis Hamilton. And we know, you know, we can see that time and again. I think for a driver like Esteban Ocon, just to Ben's point, you know, they can miss a year, maybe two, but the passage of time is damaging ultimately. They've got to be put back in the car. And I think one of the frustrations, therefore, the Toto Wolff must really be feeling is the fact that he's got this unenviable decision to make between Bottas and Ocon, because whichever way it goes, it's incredibly hard on the guy who ends up without the drive at Mercedes next year. I think Valtteri personally deserves to continue. I think actually the stability of the team would benefit from Valtteri continuing. I have a feeling that if they put Esteban Ocon in that car next to Lewis Hamilton, as we saw with Esteban and Sergio Perez at Force India, you know, he doesn't take kindly to being treated as the number two in the team. And I think, you know, Esteban, I don't know the personality, but, you know, he could be the guy that might take Toto and the Mercedes-Benz team back to the less happy days of Rosberg versus Hamilton.
But at the same time, they have to consider the long-term future of the team. You know, Lewis is nearer the end of his career than the start, and Ocon is a guy they've invested in as part of the next generation. So they're going to want to see some tangible benefit from that, I think. To let him go completely would be possibly a mistake, unless they have decided George Russell is the guy now, and everything he's learned from Lewis during his year in the back rooms and now applying to his rookie season at Williams is enough to carry him into that seat in the future and take up the mantle. Perhaps Mercedes can square the circle by retaining Bottas, which, you know, there is a fair argument to suggest he does deserve to keep his seat. Has been incrementally improving his performance, even if he can't quite make the Lewis level. He's even been copying some of Lewis's approaches, you know, trying to take more time for himself, do some more activities away from Formula One. Hasn't quite clicked yet, but maybe it will. Perhaps Ocon finds another home on the grid. Maybe the long-mooted Renault deal that's a couple of times almost happened, but not quite, is finally done. So Ocon does return to the grid, continues his development, but Mercedes includes some kind of buyback option or, clause that he can return there as and when Lewis leaves or retires, and then you get the best of both worlds. You don't lose the driver, but you also don't just leave him rotting in the reserves.
Nico Hülkenberg carries on being Formula One's equivalent of the littlest hobo. I've just made that music appear in my head.
He'll do a deal with Sauber, now Alfa Romeo, and become Kimi Raikkonen's teammate, probably. That's normally where he ends up if he
back
gets
again.
Turfed out. Yeah,
it's just incredible, isn't it? Some people, mind you, when you've been around as long as Nico Hülkenberg has and gone from one team to the other every couple of years, eventually you are going to run out of teams, aren't you? So, which is unfortunate given that he's a very capable driver, thwarted from a podium this year, which he would have richly deserved, arguably, in Germany.
Well, he crashed.
Yes.
He crashed, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I was about to say. He was thwarted because he lost.
Thwarted by himself.
He self-thwarted. Yeah. I was just reminded there of a sport, the Sebring 12 Hours, I think in 1999, where Steve Soper crashed his BMW sports car, and one of my Autosport colleagues went bustling up to him in the paddock and said, Steve, what happened? And he just turned to him, engaged, withering Soper mode, and went, I crashed. Sorry, Soper is one of my favourite drivers in terms of just taking no nonsense from anyone. Apparently in the same shunt, his team manager had got, it was Dave Price, got on the radio show and said, Steve, there's been a big shunt. And the radio crackled into life. Dave, it was me.
That sounds like a very good Dave Price anecdote. One of the old times, great thing bosses, I have to say.
A man who claimed to run an avocado farm, but that was a myth. Anyhow, we've gone way off piste. This has gone into mad. It's because of this wailing I can hear in the background of my ears from the busker.
I think you flat-chatted yourself into the barriers.
I've gone straight off. I went straight off quite a few times playing Forza with Ed Straw and Scott Mitchell the other day in the cycled multiplayer hopper. We got a Mugello Rortathon in 1967 Eagle Westlakes, and believe you me, you know, I respected Dan Gurney a lot before that moment. Even attempting to pretend to drive a 1967 Formula One car virtually is just a ridiculous experience, albeit with a hand controller. So when people say, you know, Formula One might be more interesting with no downforce, I can hear the knock on the door, but I don't think we should go back to how it was. Anyhow, wherever Esteban Ocon ends up, next year is shaping up to be quite busy because there are likely to be 22 races on the calendar. The teams have cautiously agreed to that, and they needed unanimous agreement from the teams to go over 21. But there have been differences of opinion over how they're going to manage the restriction on engine usage. There's going to be less testing, so that's going to be quite tricky for some of the drivers.
As if it were possible.
As if it were possible to have even less testing. And Formula One's owners want to go to 24 races by 2021. And that's the topic of my column in this month's issue, where we say, is that going to be too much for the people who actually work in the sport? Obviously, as fans, we'd love to see more races. It's all right for the trio of us on F1 Racing who managed attendance at all the Grand Prix between us. We don't each go to all of them, so we don't have necessarily angry spouses. But for the people who work in the Grand Prix circus week in, week out, especially the people who arrive early and leave late, that's got to be pretty tricky, hasn't it, Mark?
The teams are going to have to employ more people to take the pressure off the race team. The race team will effectively move from being the team that sets everything up and pulls everything down completely away from that. I mean, they already have the support teams that turn up after a race on a Sunday night to help them with all the packing. I think there'll be a race team, and there'll be effectively a transport team. There's so many issues that come out of 24 races. There's the fact that it feels like dilution of Formula One in some way. So when there were 14 races or 16 races, it was each race is a massive activity. Somehow we seem to be spread a little bit more thinly. Is this also very much about just growing revenue and profitability? So in other words, if Liberty have not been able to get all the races that have been renewed recently to pay the kind of amounts that Bernie Ecclestone used to get out of them, you know, the margins are reduced, so therefore you need more races to generate more revenue in order to show an upward trajectory on your income stream. So it's all about business. And it seems extraordinary that 24 races now is coming over the horizon. And the teams will, I think, find it difficult to, in themselves, see the benefit of 24 races, other than the fact that if it cements the profitability of Formula One, which of course the teams are very reliant on for their payments from Formula One, I mean, that ends up just purely being a financial decision that they're prepared to go along with it. And so as ever, it's professional sport coming down to the money equation.
Yeah, that's spot on. I think that it's all about the money, isn't it? Follow that and you'll find the answer.
Yeah, doing more with less is always quite tricky, but
the way of the world.
Yeah, well, we all have to do it, don't we? But the thing I notice from having been kind of in and around the F1 paddock for a few years now, just talking about Lewis Hamilton coming to the end of his career made me feel quite old because I first met him when he was 15. But you do see a lot of the same faces in terms of the mechanics. You know, the people who actually kind of do the spanner work, the skinned knuckle stuff, you do see a lot of familiar faces, a lot of them who are sort of a little bit older and have probably been at it a long time. But the team catering staff, the hospitality people, seem to rotate a lot more often. You see people who maybe do one or two seasons and then go off. So I don't know if that sort of speaks to the relative age of people who work in hospitality. They come in very young and with, you know, the rose-tinted spectacles on, and then they find it's a bit hard and want to leave after a couple of years, whereas maybe the mechanics this is what they've always wanted to do, so they stick with it. It's sort of a tricky thing, and some teams you see have the same mechanics who've worked there through multiple incarnations of that team.
It all depends on the individuals, doesn't it? It's not, I believe, even as it is now, a particularly sustainable existence for people at the coalface, and that is only going to get worse as the calendar expands. And some of the teams already, as life circumstances alter and get in the way of people committing to all the races, they have sub in and sub out systems. So you might get a strategist who does one race on and one race off, and then alternates with someone else who also wants to be at least partly factory based. You get some who just go back to the factory full time because they can't stomach the travel anymore, or their life dictates that they just can't commit to any races. But I'm just not sure how it all fits in with the way Formula One is meant to be going from a technical and sporting point of view. If you've got a budget cap in place, how does that fit with the need to do more races and potentially employ more people in order that you can rotate them so they don't all burn out? Will shortening the race weekend, as has been mooted, and introducing more standard parts, so in theory you make the cars easier to work on and less to do over those weekends, will that make the difference? Probably not. Ultimately, like Mark says, it seems that Liberty are trying to make the equations all add up. They're getting less money in, so they're trying to find more ways to get money in, and at the same time squeeze the budgets of the team so they can offer them less prize money, and then somehow you end up with a increased profit for the owner.
Yeah.
But there are going to be casualties in that model, and it's probably going to be the rank and file.
Sean Bratches will come motoring in with some complete gobbledygook to explain that, as he does, and we'll all just sort of nod and our brains will spin as we try and work out what he actually said.
The fact remains that we have to get the commercial ecosystem of the sport correctly balanced with good synergies between the day-to-day execution of the sport and the revenue streams across a number of different platforms. That's the kind of thing that he might say.
Yeah. You just
it's like Bratches suddenly appeared on the podcast.
He said ecosystem, he said synergies.
Synergies,
and
yeah.
My brain went, ah.
Much more pertinently, and I don't normally ask you guys questions, so I'm gonna what do you think about the prospect of 2-day weekends? So if you have 24 races and then you just have Saturday with two practice sessions in the morning, qualifying in the afternoon, maybe even the reintroduction of a warm up session on a Sunday morning to get more track time. What's your view on that? Does that destroy things for Formula One in some way, or does that actually make complete sense in a 24 race calendar?
I'm not sure it does, actually, because Formula E does quite a good job in a compressed weekend. I mean, there's a lot of differences between Formula One and Formula E, but they make it happen. I suppose the pushback from that would be from the circuits, who need a three or four day attendance from people paying for tickets in order to make the numbers add up.
I'm not a fan of Friday practice in Formula One, simply because it seems to just allow more time for the teams to perfect everything and make the races more predictable. So I think you could lose it from the point of view of the competition and the ultimate spectacle. But that said, I think you still need some kind of activity going on in the days leading up to the races for the circuits to make their events viable. You know, they sell tickets to people on that Friday. You've got to give them something, otherwise they lose revenue, and then you're into the same problem of trying to renegotiate race deals with people who are getting less for their money and will want a cut. So yeah, I'm in favour of losing Friday practice, but I'm not necessarily in favour of losing Friday from the Formula One schedule.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point, because when you look at what actually happens on Friday practice, it's enabling the better resourced teams to get more out of their product, isn't it? And as a spectacle at that, I'm not sure it adds much for the viewers. I don't know what the Sky viewing figures are like, but I don't imagine many people tune into Friday practice. Certainly not many people turn up to watch trackside. So,
but those that do will really want to retain it, because it's an extra day of watching your heroes and the cars going around the track, isn't it, that you otherwise won't get. So I think you do need to be sensitive to that.
You need something, that's for
sure. What about Ben, if you had a Friday where the fans who turn up get unrestricted access to the team? And I don't mean from a barrier 10 meters away. I mean, actually get to do what I used to do in the early stages of my career. I could walk into a garage and go and have a look as a punter, not as a professional, as a punter, I could go and stand at the front of the garage in Brands Hatch and have a look at, you know, Nicky Lauda's McLaren, or go and have a look at Nigel Mansell's Lotus, and you know, the drivers would be standing there and they'd come over and they'd sign autographs, and it was so goddamn exciting. And everything is now so distant. My view is that if a 2-day weekend did happen, the Friday needs to become a fan festival, just total access, and the teams make a real feature out of, you know, who can out-welcome their competitors in terms of the fans.
I think the Americans would certainly get behind that. The Liberty Media people would love that. I've got another idea. Bring back Procar.
Oh, now we're talking. Yeah, now we're talking. You know, it's interesting, when Nicky Lauda passed away tragically earlier this year, people finally remembered that beyond Formula One, him winning the Procar Championship and that wonderful BMW M1, and that was such a great series, short-lived, but how amazing that was. It'll never happen again, I get, unfortunately, because of manufacturer contracts and all the rest of it. But
it was the making of Ron Dennis, wasn't it? The Procar, Project 4 did all the building. Because was it Lamborghini got the deal and then couldn't actually make them? I vaguely recall.
I don't know the history of it, but you're absolutely right. The Project 4 team really cut its teeth, and the relationship with Marlborough grew from there, and it kind of led through to the Ron Dennis takeover of McLaren.
This would normally be my cue to do a Ron Dennis impersonation, but that would be highly suboptimal. So
I
think we all agree that the spectacle of watching all the drivers in equal cars for a show race before the main event would be great. Much better than watching them all drone around optimizing their setups, as
yeah.
I would say.
And that horrendous flatbed truck of doom where someone has to go around interviewing them as they fiddle with their phones and look uninterested, and occasionally by the time she gets to some of the, especially you can sense Rosanna's frustration by the time she gets down the end of the line, and she just says something like, oh, what are you thinking? And I kind of think, speed the day when a driver responds by saying, well, I'm just mulling Kant's categorical imperative right now. But it will never happen. We round off our discussion of what's gone on in the issue this month with what I consider to be the best column ever you, Mark, have written.
You saved the best for last.
I have indeed. As was it Beverly Craven who sang that? Anyhow, we're digressing again. Apologies.
Is this the best column I've written starting from a very low base?
Now, you might like to say that. I couldn't possibly comment. But I have to say, when you introduce a lot of scuttlebutt, all of a sudden things get absolutely mega. Now, you use the rich energy situation as your jumping off point. And at the time of recording, it's still a little bit up in the air. We've just this morning, we're recording this on Tuesday. It'll be launched on Thursday. As of this morning, Haas are still identifying themselves as the Rich Energy Haas F1 team. So the assumption is that when the cars pop out of the garage in Spa this weekend, they will be they'll still have the black and gold livery, they'll still carry Rich Energy branding, but not the Stag logo, which has been the subject of litigation this year. And in your column, you use that as a jumping off point to relate some fantastic anecdotes about your brushes with random sponsors and sundry crooks and mountebanks in Formula One over the years.
Because it's a sport of big money, it attracts all sorts. And of course, big money attracts people who think they can get a slice of it. And so whether you're a Rich Energy launching an energy drink, you just come into Formula One, do a bit of a Red Bull. Before you know it, you'll be selling 5 billion cans of drink and buying a private island in the Pacific like Dietrich Mateschitz, owner of Red Bull. But of course, then you find out that it's much more complicated than that. So the Rich Energy saga, kind of, to me, is illustrative of the fact that to come into this sport and to do a credible job requires a bit more than just chancing your arm. So really, up until the end of the 1990s, turn of the century, I mean, every year we seem to have a rogues gallery somewhere in the paddock. You'd have someone crop up. But you know, the point of my column is that it does attract the odd dodgy character, and it's incumbent on the teams to make sure that they vet who they are doing business with and make sure that it's legal, that they are credible, that they're authentic, that they're going to benefit the sport, benefit the team, and not lead to a gross embarrassment, which is what some of the rich energy stuff has amounted to.
What a great feature that would be, the annual Rogues Gallery.
The Rogues Gallery. You do have chances. There's a lot of fantasists and time wasters. And as Mark says, yeah, there are people who think that people who've got a little bit of money, maybe not their own money, it's usually other people's money they're playing with, but they see it as once they've got their foot in the door that they will access more money and the gold will pour from the ceiling. Because I remember when Rich Energy first appeared on the scene as a potential suitor for the then Force India team, we of course did that thing that anyone can do, which is go and look at their records and company's house and see they've only got a few grand in the bank, and you think, well, where's this supposed 15 million coming from to buy in installments this team? William Story, the CEO, said, oh, well, you know, I've got supporters and backers. The money isn't necessarily in the bank. These are old records because you filed from the previous year. We've got a great big suitcase full of cash under a toadstool in the Isle of Man. One of the red lines you find with people who are trying it on is that they try and pay you with installments, don't they? So they wanted to pay for Force India with installments. And it seems that one of the contractual issues we've had this year is that the first tranche of money arrived with the Haas F1 team, but then another instalment of 6 million was due round about June this year, and that seems to be about when it all started getting very, very weird between the two parties in a spat that we really haven't quite seen resolved yet.
And what's always difficult to know is whether the money was coming and just didn't arrive from backers that you were, you know, having conversations with and, you know, sleeping partners and what have you, or whether it was all just a big front to gain some publicity, and that you never had the money in the first place and never had the intention of paying subsequent instalments. But I mean, Haas always said that they were paid the first instalment, so yeah, there was some legitimate money there. It's just that the overall project has seemed to have gone off the rails.
Yeah, some people on social media were getting very angry with news organisations for not laying into the whole thing, but the best information we had was that the money had arrived. So, in be that as it may, you have to kind of say, okay, well, some money has actually changed hands, so we have to stay away from this right now and just keep a weather eye on it.
It's not unknown for an entity that wants to do a big deal to raise just enough money for the first payment. And their business model is, well, we make the first payment and then the success of the business will be so instantaneous. You know, we'll have so much money coming in, we'll then be able to afford the second or the third payment coming down the line. And of course, I think as I wrote in an earlier column this year about Rich Energy, you know, if you spend any time with Dietrich Mateschitz at Red Bull and you listen to how long it took Red Bull to get their product off the ground, to build profitability, to get into distribution and into markets, this is not something that's counted in weeks or months. This is something that's counted in many, many years. Again, it comes back to the stability, long-term planning, and businesses thrive over a longer period of time. So the Rich Energy thing, you know, coming in with the first payment would have been great. Obviously, it was good news to Haas to get that money in. My forecast is that you will continue to see Rich Energy all over that team and all over that car until such time as there is a legal settlement, because the simple fact is that Haas, if they haven't been paid, if they are owed money, what they need to do is to continue to honour the agreement so that when it goes to a court of law, they can say, well, we honoured our side of the agreement. We carried the branding all year. I would expect to see those cars turn up exactly as they are until such time as Haas have a settlement. Either all the money's paid and the sponsorship continues, or they're paid out of the sponsorship and it's discontinued in the correct way. But discontinuing the sponsorship by tweeting that the contract has been terminated, which is what Rich Energy did, was just one of the more bizarre things I've seen and really triggered my column.
You have dealt with quite a lot of very eccentric people, and my eye was taken by the guy who wanted you to accept a suitcase full of Swiss francs and give him a load of euros in return, which is the classic the laundry in progress.
Sitting in a restaurant in Milan with a gentleman who looked like he'd stepped out of one of the Godfather movies, and then being presented with an offer that he hoped I wouldn't refuse, which was a suitcase full of cash, was certainly one of the more surreal experiences. I'm not sure I should be mentioning this 2 weeks before I go to Italy for the Italian Grand Prix. He might be waiting for me at the airport. It's interesting, and you do come up against all sorts in this business, just because of the amount of money involved in it, and sometimes people want a slice of it. But I'm very glad you said what you said, Stuart, and not just to keep the lawyers happy. You know, vast majority of sponsorship deals that are conducted in Formula One are with proper companies and proper people, and they pay their bills, and it keeps the wheels turning.
Did you ever experience the inverse of that, i.e. someone who you thought, this is going to be a complete load of bull, turn out actually to be a great investment?
My gut reaction, first off, is no. you know, if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, and quacks like a duck, it's usually a duck. So there's not really many surprises. And the other thing that quite often happens in Formula One is where you get the really small sponsor who turns up, and a team says, okay, we'll do a deal with them because it's going to grow into a big one. And a lesson I learned early on in my career working with Eddie Jordan was that doesn't happen. So using a sprat to catch the mackerel, doesn't happen. They stay small. They become just as difficult to service as the big sponsors, and ultimately it leads to disappointment. So always best to say to people, if you want to come into Formula One, have the money to do it properly, and understand that when you do a deal, that's probably going to be the size of the deal. It's unlikely to escalate beyond what people are prepared to pay in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, the point I was going to raise is you do get a lot of kind of the people from that we would categorise as dreamers and fantasists, don't you, who just want to be a part of Formula One. And as I was saying to Ben earlier, my first experience of this type of person came in my very first day as a motorsport reporter in a paddock at the 1999 Mossport round of the American Le Mans series, when a guy accosted me in the paddock and introduced himself and his driver to me. He showed me pictures of his papaya orange McLaren F1 long tail that he was racing in the British GT Championship with this guy, Chris Goodwin, who comes with a brilliant pedigree. He was McLaren's test driver at the time. But there was something a bit kind of weird about him that didn't ring true. And it was when he said that, oh yeah, Chris and I just came over on Concorde. And I kind of thought, well, Concorde, you'd have flown to New York and then had to take another plane to come to Toronto. Why did you do that? Why did you just fly direct? You're just sort of spunking money on nothing. And that kind of set off a few alarm bells. And sure enough, he was never seen again.
I recall sitting in the Jordan office one day and having a phone call from Mr. Heineken in Amsterdam who wanted to talk to me. And I'll do the legal bit now. This is no reference to Heineken, the sponsor of Formula One. But, of course, that's who I thought it was. And he said that he wanted to sponsor the team, and he's going to – actually, he would like to buy the team, and that would be rebranded as Heineken. And I then had his wife call me, and so I ended up spending – best part of about 6 or 8 weeks talking to Mr. and Mrs. Heineken on a daily basis about how they were going to basically take over Jordan and transform the company and give us untold riches. And then the key point was they said they were going to send their BBJ for me. You know what that BBJ is, Stuart?
I have no idea what a BBJ is.
Well, I asked Eddie Jordan what a BBJ was, and I won't tell you what his reply was. Indeed, but it started with big, and then the BJ bit, you can probably imagine. It's actually a Boeing business jet. So they were offering to send their Boeing business jet over to Kidlington to pick me up and bring me to Amsterdam to conclude the deal. And all that happened was, after 8 weeks, I got bored and I just stopped taking their calls. And they continued phoning for about a year.
Wow, that's persistent.
That's very weird, isn't it?
None of us ever worked out what they were doing, other than wasting our time, because they weren't the famous drinks company, and they were just on some kind of bizarre kind of living their life vicariously through pretending to do a big deal in Formula One. It was just weird.
We get it in the journalism trade. As I mentioned to Ben earlier, beginning of the 2010 season, a guy phoned me who'd got their got my contact out of the Formula One Black Book, and I was a freelancer at the time, and he wanted to start an e-zine, and he offered me equity in his company if I were to get in with him at the ground floor of this business. And I kind of thought, well, you know, this is interesting. I was a freelancer at the time. I wasn't spending my own money going to races. So I kind of thought, well, you know, this would be a meet. This might be an interesting business to be part of. And then I said, what's your setup for actually getting people to pay for this easy? And what's your subscription model? And he said, oh, well, you know, it'll be free at first. And then I'm investing in some new technology. And that was when I kind of tuned out, because I thought, well, firstly, you're setting the perceived value of your product for zero, and then you're expecting people to pay for it through something that hasn't even been invented yet. So I kind of made my excuses and left. But this fellow, it subsequently came about, did kind of launch what looked like a WordPress powered blog with some random illiterate scribble on it, but a lot of people were left out of pocket. I spoke to a guy who'd written 20,000 words for this fellow, for which he was never paid, and
a quarter of a book.
Yeah, exactly. We did some looking into this guy. It turns out he was also impersonating a Formula One photographer with whom he seemed to share a surname on Facebook to stalk people in Formula One. He was also appearing as a frequent contributor in certain threads on the Autosport forums, generally slagging off F1 media people. But he had a particular bee in his bonnet about a journalist who I won't name, who operates a subscription e-zine, which I won't name, but which has been going for a long time. And he was saying that this fellow must earn around £200,000 a year from it or something, which I thought was quite some way north of the actual figure. So
he'd love to be earning half of £200,000 out of every year.
Exactly. So hence this fellow's urgency to start his own e-zine and then work out how he's going to get paid for later. But
to the point, Stuart, so many people look inside the world of Formula One and think, oh, there must be an easy way to make money out of this. You know, if you remember the MasterCard Lola team, which turned up in Melbourne in 1997.
Oh, indeed, yeah.
Trailed around 6 seconds off the pace and was never seen again. I mean, the background of the MasterCard Lola deal, someone came up with the idea that if you could, let's say, MasterCard have 500 million customers around the world. So the idea was that you basically got MasterCard to give you their mailing list. You would then be able to mail those 500 million people and offer them the chance to join the kind of the Lola MasterCard Formula One team club. And they reckoned that, you know, maybe 5% of that 500 million would join the club. So, you know, you'd all of a sudden have 25 million people in your club, and they would pay 50 quid each a year to be in the club. So, my goodness, you know, you're just going to have got money coming out of your ears, you know.
Yeah, someone started on the abacus and then wouldn't put it down, would they, with that?
It was just like going to make a fortune. And per Eric Broadley, it was just never going to take off. So it's, you know, again, just to the point, people look inside the sport and they see hundreds of millions of fans and they think, well, wow, we can make money out of this. It's a lot harder than you think. And there's a reason why the big, extremely good teams and companies in the sport who've been around a long time operate to successful business models. And whether you're Williams at the back of the grid, which is a profitable company, or whether you're Ferrari or Red Bull at the front of the grid, which are profitable teams, I mean, they're run by decent business people who know what they're doing, and it cannot easily be emulated.
The digital dial on this brand new and now fully functional and operational Blake 7 style mixing desk says we've gone on for over an hour, so it's time for us to bring this podcast to an end. We will be back next month with another Flat Chat podcast. A thank you to my guest, Mark Gallagher from Down the Line in France.
Thank you very much.
Will you be with us next time? Where are your travels taking you next time? Where are you going to be in about a month's time?
So I'm very pleased to say I'll be in Monza and then I'll be in Singapore. So, yeah, perhaps just when I get back from the Singapore Grand Prix.
I think we'd better leave. The way our IT systems are working right now, I think it's better off waiting until you get back from Singapore. And Ben, thank you very much. We have got a new issue. I don't know if I've mentioned it, the new issue of F1 Racing magazine.
If you haven't done, you better do it now.
Yeah, do it now. Keep us in work, please.
Don't take Ross Brawn's advice and not read. We encourage everyone to. Yeah, buy publications and read them.
Whether you're in the sport or not in the sport, read F1 Racing. You can subscribe via f1racing.co.uk. There are some fabulous offers. I think you get some free time on autosport.com. So as well as our own content, as one must call written work these days, there's an offer to access some of the fabulous Autosport Plus content, which you can get via our website, autosport.com. So that's a marvellous offer. Go to f1racing.co.uk to find out what those issues are. I've been Stuart Codling. The producer has been Martin Lee.